Talk given Friday, 18th March, 1977. The fruition of the human being is the end point, the result of the living of the religious life. What do we mean by this fruition? Does it mean the fulfilling of one's desires, or the safeguarding of oneself in face of the difficulties, the threats to one's health and happiness, and life itself, to security, and so forth? Does it mean all that, or does it mean something else? It is very important to understand this clearly, otherwise we will find sooner or later that we are deceiving ourselves, that we are living the religious life by following a course of thought in terms of, say, set meditations or whatever it is, and of action which is not in fact religious living. Because such action and such thought is really centered around the self. And yet, it is a significant thing that happiness in the true sense, that security, to use the Buddha's phrase, for example, security, the uttermost security from the bonds, the state of bondage, the ill state in life, is realized. Also, that one's fruition is not one's own fruition, but the fulfillment of perfect manhood, of manness, if I may use such a word, through the particular individual who really lives the religious life from moment to moment. Ordinarily, we do not see at all the extent to which we deceive ourselves all along the line, the extent to which we are the slaves of our desires. We are very superficial. We want the best of both worlds. Outwardly, consciously, somewhat after the fashion in which a man or a woman titivates himself or herself in order to present a fair face to those around. We follow a certain course in our daily life and think we are living religiously, when in actual fact we are not doing anything of the sort. We are very self-oriented. And this self-orientation, this state which involves inward fear and the passion to indulge our senses in any and every form, play their part without our knowing it. This is extremely important. Take one of these signs of this slavery to pleasure, the indulgence of the senses. How often we have certain compulsive states of mind. Either we have a tune on the brain, or the recollection of some pleasant event, or conversation, or, on the contrary to that, we undergo anxiety and fear about certain situations. Why do we have a tune on the brain of which we cannot be free? Because whilst we have a tune on the brain, it is impossible to attend fully, completely, to the immediate present. That tune is something which gives us pleasure. And the same applies to the functioning of every single sense that we have. Sense of touch, hearing, sight, and so forth. It comes up in the mind all the time. It is there in the background. And it comes into the foreground not only when one has nothing special to do at the moment, but whilst one has to attend to so many other things in the immediate now. It comes up, it intrudes. This is an extraordinary manifestation of the power of pleasure lust in our lives. Now you might think, oh, there he goes, killjoying. Not the least bit. There is no fulfillment or fruition in the complete and profound sense without the full tide of right pleasure. The pleasure which maintains the health, the wholeness of the organism. But the outstanding feature of this pleasure is that it comes unsought. It is something which one never plans to obtain. If the senses function perfectly, are at peace all the time, then one is very much awake, very much more profoundly awake to all the impressions that come from outside through the senses to us. And throughout the day, with very, very rare exceptions, throughout the day, there are so many impressions which are remarkably pleasurable. But that pleasure is something which never upsets one's poise. This is an important point. It is pleasure which has gone beyond sensation. There is no ecstasy involved in this. There is a very quiet, serious, fulsome delight which fills one's whole being, a state of rapture which is perfectly quiet and balanced, and it passes away, it moves out. And if one finds oneself trying to capture it and hold it, then one immediately brings it down to the level of sensationalism for oneself. It is always for oneself because one doesn't let go. If one lets go, then it means that it is not a selfish, a self-oriented experiencing of true pleasure. Now, consider how much we are the slaves of this in our daily life. Take eating, drinking, what we call being sociable, participating in jollity with friends or at the pub or whatever it is. We think that it is rude to excuse oneself. Another little drink wouldn't harm you. Do we ever say, no thank you, excuse me? Do we ever exercise the right sort of self-restraint which is not repressive? Just think of it very, very carefully. Examine it. And it is the same with respect to our feeling of security. The bank balance has to be right, this has to be right, that has to be right, and so forth. What are we afraid of? Hurt, pain to one's own psychophysical organism and or to those to whom we are attached. I deliberately use the word attached rather than say those whom we love. If we loved truly, completely, then we wouldn't get into these states of anxiety and fear in relation to the person whom we say we love, but in fact to whom we are attached. And it is because of that state of attachment that it comes back upon ourselves. It is our self being hurt and upset that is really the most powerful factor there, not the other person. You see, I hope I don't sound harsh or unfeeling, as one may say. It is the truth that heals. When one sees the fact as the fact, and one sees in wholeness, then this poison of selfness and self-preservation and self-gratulation does not intrude itself upon the whole situation. Then what happens is that one is properly awake inside oneself, wholly sensitive to the entire situation, not to a particular person or particular persons, which always means, therefore, also to one's own self, the dear me. See? Now this is one of the great difficulties. But this is the meaning of living the religious life. Consider that word, religion. Cicero uses thinks of the word religio as derived from re legere, which means to relate to look back to. But others like Servius, Lactantius, St. Augustine related the word religio to religare, to bind back to restore back to what? The totality, the whole, transcendence itself, God, as they called it. To bind back to completely be reinstated in the totality. Now, it's very interesting, there is a slight difference between the two ways in which the word religion is regarded, one by people like Cicero and the other by these others whom I have mentioned. But this latter way, to religare, to bind back, is the way in which, on the whole, people have regarded religion. But this reinstatement into the totality, is not this one of the profound meanings of the word yoga? And it's a very, very strange thing that which in India, in that language, is called yoga, is something which is common to all the great religions of the world. Ordinarily, one doesn't associate yoga, for example, with Judaism. But if you study the works of Abraham Abu Lafia, who was one of the great Jewish mystics, who was a contemporary of the famous Moses de Leon, who finally compiled the Zohar. The meaning of Zohar is the Book of Splendor, which is one of the peak points of the Kabbalistic teaching, And they were all contemporaries, St. Thomas Aquinas, Dante, Eckhart, Tauler, and these people. Abraham Abulafia distinctly gives the teachings of yoga, so much so that modern Jewish scholars themselves have pointed that out. So now, this reinstatement into the totality. And another interesting point in this connection is that the greatest obstacle to this reinstatement has been pointed out by all the great religious and or other spiritual teachers. The greatest obstruction is the indulgence of the senses. Indulgence, not the right use. Pleasure will inevitably come. Can you avoid pleasure when you see a beautiful sunset? Or just look out of the window onto the street and see a tiny little tot prancing along with the joy of life in every limb, exuding it. And when you look at that, you're just filled with this quiet delight. You can't help it. Or look at a wonderful sunset or a flower or anything at all. All that life itself, all that the whole cosmos pours out onto you, it has its opposite dual also. The cosmos presents us with earthquakes and floods and most terrible suffering. There is no pleasure here. There is pain here. But have you ever tried to enter into that pain completely? It's very, very much more difficult than entering into the happy things that life presents us. But try and enter into that pain completely and see what happens. This terrifying, destructive aspect, so-called. This is where perhaps Tibetan Buddhism saw very, very deeply indeed has this extraordinary presentation of wrathful deities and peaceful deities and so forth. Other religions also have it in their own different ways. You enter into this pain, and if you really enter into it wholly and completely, the self will not be there, oneself. It will not be my pain, I don't like it, I want to get rid of it. I want to be free of it, it's too horrible. Enter into it completely. And you will find that you will associate this, which the world would not unjustifiably from dualistic standards call destruction and horror and so forth, is completely interwoven with creation, with love, with peace, with happiness. You might say, this is a more extraordinary thing to say. Associate the horrible things, the painful things, the destructive things with happiness. go to one of your greatest teachers, who is always with you, your own body. Let us assume that you are not suffering from any illness, but you are enjoying good health. What is taking place all day, throughout the day, inside this little microcosm, the body? There is the pleasure-pain mechanism at work. There is the taking in of sustenance throughout the whole day. Breath particularly, you take in all through the day. Food and drink you take in at certain times. You take that in, it undergoes a process. The body as a whole goes through a process of assimilation and of rejection. There is a destructive aspect to the living process of the healthy body. There is a constructive process. The demons and the angels, they all work together in one mighty harmony. And you are enjoying a perfectly healthy body. But you are quite unaware of the work of the demons, the catabolic agencies inside the body. But if they didn't do their work, their horrible work of destroying certain things, the friendly bacteria inside your body, which absolutely pounce upon and wage war to the death with the deadly viruses that would otherwise kill you. Now, you accept that, don't you? You don't even know that it goes on. Now, supposing this body as a single whole body, as a single whole person, I'm saying, when I say body, I mean the whole person really, could be attentive in such a manner as to be aware of this with respect to the universal process. Would it not have this transcendent happiness, this transcendent healthiness, wholeness, with the totality of what life gives you? It is due to selfness, to preventing myself from being reinstated into the transcendent real. It is because I myself obstruct it that I separate out happiness and misery, that I separate out pleasure, pain. Now, this is something of great importance. Because we separate things out like that, because we are not awake in terms of wholeness, this is where Zarathustrian religion has a wonderful teaching. One of the six great attributes of the Supreme is Hauvatat. Health, wholeness, holiness. No, I lost my thread suddenly. What did I say before?
Wholeness and the darkness and
the extremes. Yes, but just before that?
Yes.
If there is this sense of complete wholeness, this complete acceptance, then you are man in the true and the full sense of the word. I've got the point, yes. In that state, the state in which there is complete acceptance, not acceptance as the opposite of non-acceptance or rejection, but if there is this state of complete acceptance, then one is completely free from doubt. Why do we suffer when we doubt? Why do we get unbalanced, perplexed, confused, agitated because of doubt? Because this doubt is not the totally open-minded and the free from self-orientation investigation of fact as fact. But if there is this state of complete acceptance, you are in total and complete relationship with everything. Whether that relationship is actually experienced by the particular person as a pleasure-pain experience, whether it is a experience, whether one goes through it that way or not, it makes no difference to the fact that there is no doubt involved. There is no, because you are free, because in that state one is free from wishing a particular result. This is one of our supreme difficulties in living the religious life. We want a particular result. We have an outlook, our own personal purpose. Our poor little intellect, or intelligence as we call it. But if one's own desires, one's own intellectual processes were to be perfectly quiescent, were to be only instruments for something profounder, then what takes charge of the particular finite individual? That which takes charge is that which has no doubts, which has no fears, which has no personal desires. You see the difference. If we can understand this, you will understand why I keep on saying all the time, beware of trying to live the religious life in the real sense. Keep away from religion, for goodness sake, if it is the petty things of life that you really care for. The indulgence of the self, of the senses, the indulgence of what we call our cultural side. This development of the cultural side, which is born out of a society which has always been self-oriented, is only a self-gratification. It is not a case of being reintegrated into the total reality, the total truth. If we play at this game, of religion, this pretense. Oh, faithful member comes regularly to every meeting and this, that and the other, shuts his eyes and is very pious looking and all the rest of it. You know. All these postures of piety and so forth are monumental impediments to reality. I am being one of the demons, the demonic forces breaking down things, you see. But if we are to allow the really lovely plant to grow, do we promote the growth of weeds? Or see what is a weed and, as we say, weed it out? Now you see where our hypocrisy and self-deception comes in, is that we want the best of both worlds. Oh, have another drink, you know, another little, what is it, double scotch or something. Oh, all right, I won't say no, thank you, and so forth, you see. This is the thing one has to really to beware of. It's in the everyday things, the indulgence of the senses. When one can be free of both attachment and aversion towards everything sensational, then this profounder reality, which is pure happiness, fills the whole organism. And it is this happiness, this state of rapture, quiet rapture, remember, which is an essential constituent which one must have in order that one may meditate in the true sense of the word. You know, all the great religious teachings, the Upanishads, the Buddha's teachings, all that the great Christian mystics, Islamic mystics, everybody has brought this out. Whatever the religion may be, you see, that when there is this complete noting of the self, this complete self-surrender, and a self-surrender which has gone right past the state of conscious surrender, it is just there, naturally, when this has taken place, then happiness, security, the state of inward rapture, which enables you to be continuously in the state of meditation, comes about. The Buddha particularly says it over and over again, that in this state of rapture, the body, for example, is impassible. Normally with us, the body is an impossible affair. But the body becomes impassible. It becomes free of reaction to pain particularly, painful sensation, as well as to pleasurable sensation. And in this state, there is this attunement, this complete at-one-ment. Then there is no doubt as to what the truth is, as to what one's course of action should be. When we suffer from doubt in relation to what we call truth, it simply means that this truth for us is still a conceptual and verbal formulation. But truth in the religious context, truth in the context of man's fruition and fulfillment, is nothing conceptual and verbal, nothing at all. If you find concepts coming in, let me put it this way, if you find concepts emerging, certainly let them emerge, observe them very carefully, fully, extract whatever may be the essence of that, and let the concept go. Because the concept is the form which will inevitably perish. But that which you really extract, the essence which you extract, is that which is built into faculty, spiritual faculty, into pure intelligence, the power to see the truth of things in the immediate present. What room is there for doubts then?